Chris Boyd. Up next on Think, Houthi rebels in Yemen have claimed responsibility for two drone attacks on major Saudi oil facilities. The U.S. suspects Iran, and international oil prices have spiked sharply. What exactly is going on here? We'll spend this hour with Jim Crane, an expert on the geopolitics of the energy industry. We'll talk about why Houthi rebels might claim credit for a bombing they didn't pull off, about options for a U.S. and Saudi response, and about whether John Bolton's recent departure from his post as National Security Advisor had anything to do with the timing of the attack. Our conversation starts after a short break. Arabia's oil output has been significantly reduced by a pair of drone attacks last weekend on two major oil production facilities. Houthi rebels in Yemen say they did the damage, but U.S. leaders suspect Iran is to blame, and they're working through how to respond if those suspicions are confirmed. Iran, for its part, is warning it has rapid and crushing retaliations planned in the event of any U.S. aggression. Meanwhile, global markets are nervous about a crisis that could get far worse than pulling some Saudi production capacity offline, and consumers are already paying more for gas. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. There are a lot of threads wrapped up in this Gordian knot, and we've asked an expert here to help us untangle them. Jim Crane is Wallace S. Wilson Fellow for Energy Studies at Rice University's Baker Institute for Public Policy. Earlier in his career, he wrote about the Middle East and the Persian Gulf as a journalist for the Associated Press, The Economist, The Financial Times, and The Wall Street Journal. And he's got a book out called Energy Kingdoms, Oil and Political Survival in the Persian Gulf. Jim, welcome to Think.
Oh, well, thanks. It's great to be here.
What do we know about how these attacks were carried out?
Well, it's we're starting to get a pretty interesting picture. It's looking like potentially the launch site was the Ahvaz Air Base in southwestern Iran, so right at the head of the Persian Gulf next to Iraq. Now, that's a possibility. That's not confirmed yet. So, and it looks like about two dozen or just under two dozen armed drones and about seven or eight cruise missiles flew over Kuwaiti airspace and then into Saudi Arabia from the northeastern side, so sort of the unprotected side of Saudi Arabia, if you will. And they were way more accurate than just about anybody expected. It was a major surprise. I mean, some of the imagery shows rows of these spheroid tanks with identical punctures in identical spots, one next to the other. What you would call a surgical strike almost on two sites. So one is the giant Abqaiq crude oil processing facility, and the other one is the Khurais oil field, which is not too far away from that.
The Abqaiq plant has been called the world's most critical oil facility. Is that accurate?
That's probably accurate, yes. I mean, it's sort of the jugular of Saudi oil production. So lots of different Saudi light and medium crude oil fields feed their production, their raw crude oil into the Abqaiq plant, and the natural gas is stripped out and the water is stripped out and the any metals and sulfur is stripped out, and the crude is kind of stabilized and readied for export. So it all kind of funnels through there, gets cleaned up, and then goes to the to the export point at Ras Tanura and is put on ships and sent overseas.
So how much can we know about the extent of the damage? Is any of it considered a state secret on the part of Saudi Arabia?
Well, Saudi is not always the most forthcoming with information. So, whether or not they consider it state secret or not, I'm not sure. But, we haven't been treated to a bunch of photos of the damage. Mostly we're relying on satellite imagery and the occasional bizarre YouTube video. I saw one that purports to be somebody in Kuwait shooting with some kind of footage of what he's saying is a cruise missile going overhead. Which sounds like a cruise missile, so there's not a lot of and then there's pictures of warhead cruise missile pieces laying in the sand, so there, we haven't been treated to a whole bunch of transparency on this, so it's not, so what I'm hearing, I have to, caveat this pretty heavily.
Yeah, the Iranians keep saying it wasn't them, but is there any way that the Houthi rebels would have gotten their hands on a cruise missile? Is this the kind of thing that a rebel group would have operating out of Yemen?
So the Houthis have been attacking Saudi Arabia with missiles of some sort and with drones that they are probably getting, which they seem to be getting from Iran. So the Houthi claim of responsibility for this attack initially sounded pretty plausible. I mean, this is, they've been doing this for more than a year now, attacking sites along the border, attacking the east-west pipeline, another piece of critical infrastructure in central Saudi Arabia, hundreds of miles away from the Yemeni-Saudi border. They've attacked the airport in Riyadh, again, hundreds of miles away. So initially it sounded like, yeah, this is the Houthis, wow, they've really done it this time. They've managed to hit, this critical infrastructure extremely accurately, about 700 or 800 miles away from the border. So how did they do it? But and then they claim responsibility, of course. I think as the evidence has been trickling out, it's looking less and less like that claim of responsibility is accurate, and more like maybe an information operation that the Houthis have agreed to do alongside their Iranian allies.
What is the relationship between the Houthis and the Iranians?
So it seems to be a strengthening relationship that has grown as the Saudi Arabia and the UAE have invaded and taken sides in the Yemeni civil war, which has basically been kind of kicked off in the Arab Spring, and it became the Houthis are this Zaydi Shia tribe from the northern part of Yemen. They overran the capital in 2014, and then the Saudis and the Emiratis intervened in 2015, and that pulled Iran in. So I think, Iran and the Houthis did not seem to have much contact, there wasn't a lot of support for them. There may have been some kind of nominal relationship, but once the Saudis invaded, I think, especially the Saudis, both Saudis and the Emiratis, I think Iran had a pretty big incentive to help the Houthis, to try and embarrass and bog them down. And same with the Houthis. I mean, they wanted to retain power and retain the capital, and they needed some help doing that, and Iran was only too happy to oblige.
Is it an overstatement to call this conflict in Yemen a proxy war between Iran and Saudi Arabia?
No, I mean, I think that's exactly what it is. It's a proxy war that seems to be, like the proxy war in Syria, drawing in, bigger and bigger players. It was neighboring countries. Now it's spreading to the wider region, and U.S. was sort of peripherally involved, supplying intelligence to the Saudis, and this started under the Obama administration, by the way, supplying intelligence to the Saudis. And air-to-air refueling to them. I think it's very accurate to call it a proxy war.
Are airborne attacks something that oil production facilities, civilian oil production facilities, typically consider in their security planning?
Well, probably not typically, but if you're Saudi Arabia and you're 100 miles away from Iran, you'd probably consider that. And also, this Abqaiq site especially is, has been known for a long time as being a critical vulnerability, Saudi Arabia. I mean, I was working in Dubai the first time the Abqaiq plant came under attack. You had two pickup trucks loaded with ISIS members with guns, and one of them had a bomb in it. And they crashed the gates and shot at guards and then blew up the second truck. It didn't cause any damage to the Abqaiq plant's capacity to do what it does and clean up crude oil, but it killed some people and broke some gates. But it caused a huge stir on oil markets. I mean, you know, prices reacted really quickly. I mean, you know, oil markets were much, much tighter in 2006 than they are now. So it caused a big stir. It caused a big stir inside the kingdom. All of a sudden, you started seeing, you know, the Saudis spending much more on critical infrastructure protection. And they even created a special force for critical infrastructure protection.
How can something like an oil facility defend itself from a drone attack short of an anti-aircraft system? Is there anything else they can do?
Well, you know, there might be a few things they can do. I mean, there's some anti-drone jamming technologies that they're using at, you know, Heathrow and Gatwick Airport, for example. And, you know, I don't know, maybe a really tall fence or something. I mean, you know, I'm not sure how they might do this. You know, Saudi Arabia does have some air defense systems. They've certainly spent a lot of money on U.S. Hawk and now U.S. Patriot air defense systems. But, you know, that's one of the interesting things about this attack is why none of this stuff was picked up. You know, I mean, the U.S. is now talking about reverse engineering the circuit boards in some of those cruise missiles so they can figure out the, you know, the trajectory of these things and where they came from, try to pinpoint the launch points. So we don't seem to have any great intelligence on, you know, the telemetry, the, you know, the signatures that the, that these missiles and drones left. And, you know, none of the air defenses that were in place seem to, you know, have caught on to them. So I mean, I can talk about the reasons for that if you'd like, but that seems to be the situation we're in so far.
Let's talk about that in a minute. I need to take a quick break here. My guest is Jim Crane, Wallace S. Wilson Fellow for Energy Studies at Rice University's Baker Institute for Public Policy. We're talking about the effects of weekend attacks on two major Saudi oil production facilities. Crane's new book is called Energy Kingdoms, Oil and Political Survival in the Persian Gulf. Think. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Jim Crane, who is Wallace S. Wilson Fellow for Energy Studies at Rice University's Baker Institute for Public Policy. We're talking about effects of the weekend attacks on two major Saudi oil production facilities. Before the break, Jim, you were saying that at this point it's unknown what the telemetry was, what the trajectory, exact trajectory of the missiles that hit the Saudi plants were. They need to be reverse engineered. Is it surprising that Iran or the Houthis were able to put drones or missiles on a trajectory that isn't easily detectable by the Saudis or the Americans, for that matter?
Well, these things fly really close to the ground, right? So maybe 30 or so feet above ground. So it's hard to detect things that are flying that close to the ground, right? So to answer your question, first of all, I'd say yes. I mean, it is a surprise that Iran or the Houthis were able to do something like this so accurately. You know, I was just reading a report that, you know, basically described the Iranian, at least its ballistic missile system, as pretty inept, that they, you know, their missiles were not supposed to be very accurate. Now these are cruise missiles, a little different, but and drones, so, you know, which I, you know, I the drones are definitely controlled by a you know, an operator, and I think the cruise missiles were too. But the failures of the Saudi you know, air defense system, I think, is also a really big surprise and a big strategic vulnerability. So I've been able to gather some reasons from speaking to some folks that work in the area. Why this might have happened. One is that the missile defense radars were not facing, you know, to the northeast of the upcake site, that they were facing towards Yemen or across the Gulf towards Iran directly and northward. But they, you know, the fact that these missiles and drones, this swarm, was flying so low, and the, you know, given the curvature of the Earth. You know, the Earth curves about 8 inches per mile. So if you're 30 feet off the ground, the radar can only pick you up when you reach about 45 miles away, which does not give you much warning that there's a that there's an incoming threat. And these also, both of these types of projectiles are small, right? So an operator might confuse them for a goose, or the software for the air defense systems might have thought these were these things were so small that they were filtered out as noise. And then there's operator error, right? I mean, oftentimes, from what my friends in who do this kind of stuff say, that when you have an attack, often the first attack is successful because of operator negligence, right? Folks are asleep at the switch. So the first time there's an attack of any sort, they're always the hardest to catch. So it could be any number of reasons why this one got through.
Any possibility the Iranians are getting help from the Chinese or the Russians or some other third party?
Well, yes, there's a possibility. I don't know. For sure, but I know the Iran was a big buyer of foreign missile technology, a lot of which was being smuggled through Dubai, as well as nuclear weapons and centrifuge technology that was being smuggled in over the years. So it is certainly possible.
Saudi Arabia says it holds Iran responsible for the attacks, but it has not gone so far as accusing Tehran of carrying them out. What is the significance of that distinction?
Well, I'd imagine they're probably holding their fire and keeping a few things in their close to their vest until they're ready to take some kind of action on this. I think there's still a lot of they want to have some evidence they can bring to the UN, mm-hmm. And probably the U.S. does as well. They want some convincing evidence. There's still some U.S. allies like France and Japan that have said that. Well, they're taking a wait and see on this, and I think France has sent an investigator to Saudi Arabia to take a look. So I think they're looking for some solid evidence, but they also need some time to try and figure out what the appropriate response is. I mean, I don't think Saudi Arabia or the U.S. wants this to escalate into a full blown war. But they, I think Saudi Arabia, the U.S., and most everybody else also don't want these types of escalating provocations by Iran to continue, right? So if you think about it from the Saudi perspective, this was, an act of war, as Secretary Pompeo said. I mean, this was an attack on the Saudi homeland, on its critical infrastructure. Saudis have to come up with some way of deterring this, but hopefully short of a full-blown war, and that's going to be, a tricky decision to make.
I want to talk about the timing of these strikes. Why might this have happened in the immediate aftermath of John Bolton's departure as National Security Advisor? I mean, is that just a coincidence, or could it not possibly be a coincidence?
I suspect it's a coincidence more than anything else. It was pretty quick after Bolton left. This type of an attack would probably be months in the planning. I think it's probably a happy coincidence for Tehran that this happened when Bolton had just departed, or maybe that it was a plan that was being readied, and the Bolton firing maybe just put Iran over the edge and say, okay, great, well, this is even yet another reason to launch this thing. But I don't think it was planned after the firing.
Well, there had been speculation that President Trump might sit down privately with Iranian President Hassan Rouhani at the UN General Assembly meeting next week. We'll note that Mr. Trump has denied this on Twitter, but what would have made observers think it was a possibility, such a meeting?
Well, Trump's offered to meet Rouhani, with no conditions in the past. So he's been, he's had a couple of meetings now with Kim Jong-un of North Korea. And there was sort of talk of war and some pretty bellicose rhetoric coming out of the White House and of North Korea. Then Trump managed to calm things down pretty successfully. And I mean, that's probably his biggest foreign policy success so far, is at least calming the you know, the level of heated rhetoric coming out of North Korea. And, you know, I'm sure he'd like to do the same thing ahead of the elections coming up here to be able to say, look, you know, only he could have, you know, spoken to the Iranians and, you know, and calmed the situation down. So I'm sure he'd like to, you know, to use his powers of persuasion to help assuage the situation. But it's so far, you know, I think Iran is going to want some kind of a concession before that happens. And, you know, they may have just sabotaged their chances for a talk anyway with this attack. So, you know, I think Trump seems to be walking that back now.
Yeah, the attack seems like a strange thing. Could Iran have been hoping somehow that attacking the Saudis would give them leverage in advance of a meeting with the Americans?
Well, yes. I mean, I think it does give them some sort of leverage. I mean, I think, you know, the U.S. and the Saudis, you know, they were pretty content to let Iran sit in its box and stew, you know, while it was sort of calmly accepting its fate that it was going to have to basically halt its oil exports and, you know, watch its economy, you know, be overcome by inflation and deficit and debt. So, you know, they've started lashing out, you know, over the past sort of, you know, 2 months now. You know, we've seen these sort of escalatory attacks, none of which they've claimed responsibility for, but which appear to have been caused by Iran, right? The, you know, the attacks on tankers around the Strait of Hormuz, and the, you know, the seizure of a couple of tankers, you know, in the Strait, the shooting down of a U.S. drone, and now this. So, so I think Iran has been pretty, you know, convincingly making a nuisance of itself, saying that, you know, and the Trump administration is on the back foot. It's got to respond to each one of these provocations. So I think, you know, at some point, you know, Iran is going to say, well, look, let's just get back to the negotiating table and put everything on the table. And, we'll call it off if you do. So I think it does put him in a stronger negotiating position. But it's, you know, again, it's extremely risky. Iran could come under, direct military attack from the U.S., Saudi Arabia, or both.
All right, let's take a listener call. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. We have James on the line in Dallas. Hi, James.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes.
Very nice conversation. I'm curious, other than just defending against a second attack, it seems to me that almost anything that the U.S. or our allies do is likely to just result in an increase in the price of oil. Hello?
Yes, go right ahead.
Oh, sorry. So I'm just wondering, is there anything that your guest can think of that would actually keep the price of oil, stable or not result in an increase by, for example, taking more of the supply off the market from Iran?
Mm-hmm.
Or
well, thank you very much for your call, James. What do you think about that, Jim?
So the price of oil has, you know, it's gone up by quite a bit, but then it's sort of come back down. So I think Brent, when I looked at it before coming on, was about $64. So it, you know, it's up by about $5. It's not a huge, but, you know, I think markets could tighten as, you know, over time here. It's going to take Saudi Arabia a long time to repair this Abqaiq facility. It's been moving crude out of storage and meeting all of its export contracts with its stored crude, but it's already started asking its customers to take heavy crude instead of light and medium crude, which Abqaiq processes. So we could see a bit more tightness and a bit more shortage as the Saudis draw down their inventories. Now, one thing they could do immediately the Trump administration could do immediately to bring the price of oil down, pretty unpalatable choice, allow Iran to start exporting again, right? So, I don't think the Trump administration wants to do that, but if the price of oil got to be a huge problem, he could release the Strategic Petroleum Reserve stocks, and that would work for a while. But if it got to be a huge problem, we could back away from sanctions and start, allow the Iranians to start exporting again.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Are the Saudis oil stockpiles intended for use as a trade commodity or as domestic supply or a combination of both as needed?
So I think they use it both. So, I think they use it to meet their export commitments, particularly when there's a, maintenance going on or at a refinery or at a processing plant. But mostly they're used for domestic consumption in the summertime, right, when their oil demand spikes because the Saudis burn, unlike just about anybody else in the world, the Saudis actually burn crude oil for power generation. And so they do that in the really hot months. So we're coming toward the end of that season. This is typically the time when the Saudis start replenishing those stocks. I don't know how much inventory they've got left. I'd imagine they still have a fairly, a healthy amount. But they can do that. They can use those inventories that might have gone to the power sector in Saudi.
I was astonished to read this morning, I think in the Wall Street Journal, that the Saudis are looking into importing oil from neighboring countries to meet domestic demand. Do oil pipelines have the capacity to flow in either direction?
So the Saudis don't actually have any import pipelines.
Okay.
They import crude oil. Well, they don't import crude oil normally, and I don't think that's what they're going to do this time either. I think they're going to import crude oil products, mm-hmm. right? So they do import heavy fuel oil, gasoline, and diesel, and have done for years as needed, right? So to satisfy demand, again, particularly in the summertime when demand is high. Saudis have been building up a lot of refining capacity, so they've been exporting these products for the most part, but they still do import cargoes of fuel when they need it.
My guest is Jim Crane. He is the Wallace S. Wilson Fellow for Energy Studies at Rice University's Baker Institute for Public Policy. He's author of a book called Energy Kingdoms, Oil and Political Survival in the Persian Gulf. We're talking about the effects of the weekend attacks on two major Saudi oil production facilities. This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Jim Crane. He's Wallace S. Wilson Fellow for Energy Studies at Rice University's Baker Institute for Public Policy and author of a new book called Energy Kingdoms, Oil and Political Survival in the Persian Gulf. We're talking about the effects of this weekend's attacks on two major Saudi oil production facilities. Let's go next on the phone to Clark in Hearst, Texas. Hi, Clark.
Hi, Clark. Hi, Clark. Hi. Thanks for taking a call.
Sure.
I got those names mixed up. The United States is the bad guy in this. And that would be the view of the Europeans. That would be a view of the Chinese as well as the Japanese. Hello?
Yes, go right ahead.
Okay. Let's assume that Iran did blow up the oil field. The Americans came in with the first shot by putting these sanctions against Iran. And the Americans had an agreement. The Russians were into this. The Europeans were into this, that Iran was going to slow back its nuclear ambitions in return for a lessening of sanctions. Why would we go to war with something like this? By the way, we can't win this. And we can't win it in the long term because all it does is let the Russians, the Chinese, and the Europeans, again, get the reinforced statement that the Americans are using arrogance. Yeah.
All right. Thank you, Clark. Let's get Jim Crane's position on all that. Jim?
Well, yeah, so the caller makes a really good point, right? So the Trump campaigned on, the first day he got in office, he was going to back out of the JCPOA, that Iran nuclear deal that, the caller rightly said was signed not just by the U.S. and Iran, but by a bunch of European countries, the EU itself, as well as China and Russia. So we reneged on a deal that was, granted it was signed by Trump's predecessor, but, to all the other parties in that deal, it looks like we reneged. Now, Trump seems to have gambled. If there was a strategic thinking behind this, I'm not sure there actually was, it seems to be, if you give it some strategic credence, this pullout, that it's a gamble to try and get additional concessions from Iran on either on missiles or on its support of proxies around the region, right? Iran does not seem to be willing to give on those two issues, right? Granted, they're important issues, but Iran is instead responding to the reimposition of sanctions by causing as much trouble as it can and making a nuisance of itself around the region to try and bring the other parties that are still in that deal to try to either find a workaround to get Iran's oil to market so it can revive its economy, or to talk Trump down and to try and convince the Trump administration to find a way to get back into this deal because the results of his pullout are just causing too much disruption.
What role do Israel and Iraq have in rising tensions throughout the region? What do we need to be thinking about on those fronts?
So, I mean, the problem that the U.S. has with Iran, Israel, the Saudis, and the UAE are probably the three main foreign countries that have been, foreign governments that have been urging the U.S. to take a harder line on Iran. I mean, Prime Minister Netanyahu in Israel has been probably the most vocal, even theatrical, with these televised diatribes, I guess, if you will, about Iran. So Trump has been listening to them. Iraq, not so much. I mean, there are some, Iran and Iraq are fairly allied now. The Iraqi government's pretty close to Iran, and Iran has some supports some militias inside Iraq that also back the Iraqi government. So I don't think that the Iraqis were so much pushing the U.S. to tighten sanctions again on Iran. But the Saudis and the UAE see Iran as a threat. Iran has, like I mentioned earlier, joined the civil war in Yemen, and is fighting them kind of indirectly in that war. But they also compete with Iran in oil markets, especially in the Asian oil market. And the onset of this huge new supply of oil from the U.S. has, lowered the price of oil, and is making these big exporters in the Middle East compete for the same market share, mostly in East Asia. And if with Iran out of the picture, you can see Saudi and the UAE having a little easier access to those markets and a little bit higher oil prices than they'd ever otherwise have. So I guess there's a couple of reasons why those two countries might be, eager to see Iran kept in a box.
We have an email from Mellon in Dallas who wants to know if this conflict ultimately boils down to a religious dispute between Sunni and Shia.
No, I mean, I think it's a lot broader than that. I think it's more of just regional geopolitics and countries, seeking influence. Iran is, the Houthis have given Iran a toehold on the Arabian Peninsula and given Iran some pretty major nuisance power over Saudi Arabia. Ironically, the U.S. invasion of Iraq did the same thing, gave Iran some nuisance power, to the north of Saudi Arabia. I don't think it's purely, there's a sectarian aspect to this, a little sectarian flavor to it, but there's Shia also on the, on the southern side of the Gulf in the UAE, in Saudi Arabia, in Bahrain, in Kuwait, in Oman. I don't see it in sectarian terms.
All right. Back to the phones now. We have Ted on the line in Mejia, Texas. Hi, Ted.
Hi, Chris. Real quick, a couple of months ago, the Saudis put Saudi Aramco open to investments, putting it on certain country stock markets. Have they done that? And, has anyone taken up the offer?
Thanks for calling.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, that is still in the cards, the initial public offering for Saudi Aramco. So the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia wants to sell off a 5% chunk of Saudi Aramco, which is the largest company by earnings in the world, period, right? So it earned about $242 billion last year, it shared about half of that with the Saudi government. So it is a massive massive company with huge earnings, and given climate change and worries about stranded assets and the future of oil as a transportation fuel, Saudi Arabia naturally wants to diversify its risk and build up a more diverse economy. Right now the Saudi economy is totally dependent on oil. And so one way of doing that is to sell off some shares. It has not done that yet. It's been a lot more difficult than the Saudi government has anticipated, or Saudi Aramco, or even the bankers that have been involved. It called off the IPO for a while, and now it seems to be pursuing it again, or it was until these attacks happened. It seems to be going back on hold for a little while. We may see them sell some shares, a small amount of shares, on the Saudi exchange, but they have not announced whether or not they're going to go ahead with a bigger sale on a foreign exchange, or indeed which exchange might get that sale.
Are consumer level price spikes from an event like this at all muted in the United States by the fact that we are no longer a net importer of oil?
Well, we are a net importer of oil. I mean, we still import a little bit. I think we use about 19 million barrels a day, and we're producing, 12, 13 now?
Okay.
So we're still importing some oil. Overall, the doubling or more than doubling now of our oil production has definitely muted the price spikes, not just here in the United States, but globally, right? If you think about the oil market, it is a single global market, and prices are formed all over the world. So, what happens in Saudi Arabia is affecting our oil price here at home. I think we'll see, we'll start seeing that at the pumps if it hasn't happened already. Yes, without shale, I mean, of course, it would have been a much bigger price jump, not just for us, but for everybody worldwide.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. If the Saudis determine that they are absolutely confident that Iran ordered and carried out these attacks, what does a proportional response look like? What are the options available to the Saudis to retaliate?
So I think the Saudis would like to retaliate in concert with the U.S. And I think vice versa. I don't think the U.S. wants to just jump in without the Saudis, because there was no U.S. property or personnel involved in any of these Iranian provocations, other than the shooting down of the drone. That was an unmanned drone, right? So they have a number of options. We're starting to see some of these pop up. So Trump is talking about tightening sanctions. The Saudis do not have diplomatic relations, so they can't withdraw ambassadors from Iran. They cut off diplomatic relations in 2015. We could see another cyber attack. We've seen a few of those. We could see, we don't have a lot of options for more sanctions. The U.S. has looked at the list of U.S. sanctions yesterday, and it is extremely long and comprehensive. And we've blocked Iran from even using the international financial system or U.S. dollar. So there's probably a few small marginal areas that we can sanction, but probably not I don't think Iran is super worried about that. There's talk about potentially a clandestine operation in Iran, maybe using local allies, maybe a short incursion by some U.S. troops that give us plausible deniability, in the same way that Iran has used plausible deniability for these other attacks. So it could be a combination of those things, or it even could be a return to talks. And I guess the Saudi response would probably be similar. Maybe a proportional strike on an Iranian oil facility that you know, that was similar to what happened in Saudi Arabia.
Jim Crane is Wallace S. Wilson Fellow for Energy Studies at Rice University's Baker Institute for Public Policy. His book is called Energy Kingdoms, Oil and Political Survival in the Persian Gulf. Jim, thank you so much for making time to speak with us.
Oh, anytime. I really enjoyed it. Thanks.